The Gordon McPhail story is one of evolution. It's mm-hmm. one of patience. It's one of very much a very strong set of values, doing right by not just those in the business, but those associated with the business and our local community as well.
We are Miriam,
Martin,
and Manuel. We love Scotland, travelling and whisky.
On our trips, we talk to the people to bring their stories to you and to share our love for the water of life.
This is Inside Whisky, the Barrel Talk. Today, we're in Elgin, and we're excited to talk about Gordon and McPhail, probably the most famous independent bottler in Scotland. We are here with Stephen Ranking, the Director of Prestige at Gordon and McPhail. Stephen, welcome to our podcast. You can say hello or something.
You're allowed to say hi.
Well, hello. Thank you for coming to Elgin. It's great to see you all.
Thank you for having us. So now, last week when we were making arrangements for today's recording, you said that you were overseas, not for work, but rather for competing. So what kind of competition did you attend and how did it go?
Well, we were across in Prague playing in the Savona Cup. This is a tournament that's been going on for well over 20 years now. And it features a lot of the sort of the nations that maybe you're not seeing on the television at the moment. So the Czech national ladies team were there, for example, the men, Hungarian men, Slovenia and Austria, Slovakia, all these, Poland. And
maybe for the listeners who have not talked to you in advance, could you reveal the sport?
The sport is curling. That great curling. Scottish sport.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Scotland gave the world three gifts. Whiskey, of course, golf and curling.
It's actually a nice combination of things, isn't it?
It absolutely is. So now curling, actually, are you following the Olympics?
Very, very much so. Yeah. Yes. We've got an invested interest in our household.
You're from a curling family. Is that what it means?
Yes. My wife, Janice, was Olympic gold medalist in 2002.
So.
Wow. Okay.
Amazing.
Pretty impressive. Yeah. But that also means you're traveling quite a bit with your curling equipment, and I imagine that to be very heavy. How do you do it?
The good news is you don't have to take the stones.
Oh, you don't?
No. Ah. You take yourselves, your curling shoes, and your brushes, your curling brooms.
Uh-huh. All right, so the rest is always set up where you are. Good. Now, you were talking about the family a little bit. Who's the best in the household? What would you say? You're all about competing, so are you competing about that as well?
So in a curling team, you have a team of four. I don't get on the team sheet. obviously, my wife is very good, and today she coaches youngsters and does a brilliant job of that. Then our eldest son, Jamie, he played at the Youth Winter Olympics in 2020, just before COVID, actually. And that was an amazing life experience. And then our youngest sons, Skipping Zoe, who's also very good, but she's a football player.
All right, so, okay.
But the youngest two, Fraser and Ben, they have been Scottish under-17s champions, Scottish schools champions, and were third this year overall at the under-21s. So, yeah, so Dad's I'm just the brush carrier now.
Well, that's a very impressive family sports history also.
Absolutely.
Well, we'll talk about something else today. So we'll talk about the other bit of the family business, which is Gordon at McPhail and whiskey, obviously. But we'll talk about you first. And how did you get in contact with whiskey in the first place?
It's a wonderful question. And from my point of view, obviously, my mother was the first of four children to George and Peggy Urquhart. Mm-hmm. And George Urquhart was the second generation to come into Gordon McPhail following his father, John. And he came in 1933. So the Gordon McPhail business was always in the background. But when I grew up as a young boy into teenage years, the whiskey side, of course, was only part of it because that's what we were becoming internationally famous for. Mm-hmm. But on a local level, the thing that probably touched us more was our grocer's business and the fact we did groceries and fine wines as well as distribution. So that was our my initial touch points. So it was the green van turning up in where we grew up in Inverness, which is what, an hour drive from Elgin. So that was my first contact. And of course, not being at that age allowed to drink whiskey, the whiskey side wasn't in front of my mind. However, I got some great advice from my father, mm-hmm. who said, as I approached sort of late teens, he said, look, you're going to go drinking with your friends and celebrating, and, you know, beer's great, but be really mindful that whiskey is a strong drink, but a beautiful drink. And if you overindulge, you probably won't enjoy it so much in the future. So respect it. And if you think you're going to want to get into it, let's come and sit with me and do it. Mm-hmm. So, and that was great advice, because fast forward, goodness, a long time. And if I had a pound, if I had $1, €1 for any time somebody came up to me at a show or anything and said, I'm sorry, you offer them a whiskey and they say, oh, I'm sorry, I don't want that. Because when I was young age, I overindulged and, you know, so. Mm-hmm. So it's a drink that it's phenomenal. But young age, respect it and it will respect you.
Yeah, very good, absolutely. And now, before we get to the Stephen that is sitting here in front of us right now, I've heard that you did a few summer jobs for the family business when you were still in university, like helping at Benromach. So what did you do there? What did you learn?
Yes, well, so my university studies were all in a construction discipline called quantity surveying. And that discipline is where you basically are the cost engineer on construction jobs, refurbishments, new builds. So you have to understand how a building's going to be built and mm-hmm. forecast the costs, so you can tell your client this will, you know, this refurbishment will cost you X, and they can work out if it's within their budget or not, or extend their budget, or we change the design, so, you know, to how it works, like mm-hmm. anything. So when the company bought Benromach in 1993, sadly the building was virtually, you know, it wasn't falling down, but it was
pretty
just
rundown.
Walls. It was just, mm-hmm. outer walls and a roof. Everything inside had slowly been taken away and been used mm-hmm. For parts for other distilleries and the like. And so the what was left was really just four walls and a roof. So when I went out there, I was joined by my grandfather, who at the time was 75, and an old gentleman, a wonderful gentleman called John Taylor, who was also 75 years old. So we had a combined age at the time of 171 between the three of us, and I was 21 at the time. And what we did was we went and cleared the whole site, getting ready for, as the architect and the engineers created the design for Benromach, we made sure that the site was going to be ready for everybody coming in. And so we went and secured it by taking down all the old fencing that was falling down, put out new mm-hmm. fencing, cleaned out the actual distillery of the various elements that just allowed the next part of the process to come and be fulfilled. So it was great, but it was wonderful to work alongside my grandfather and John as well, because they're old hands. They taught you so much, mm-hmm. and just, you know, this things that you wouldn't think about doing unless you were shown. Yeah. And very, very manual things as well.
It sounds very hands-on.
Hands-on.
Oh, it was very hands-on, yeah. Driving JCBs and, you know, we had to take down and sort of clear up where one of the warehouses was located. So this was already in a fairly fragile state. So when it came down, we had to then, of course, go and clear away all the brickwork and separate it all ready for it to all be removed off-site. And so it was... Yeah.
It sounds like it was not the worst summer job for university students, working with the grandfather and everything. It sounds like
a nice
memory. Yeah. And from there, I mean, you already mentioned, or we all know already, that you are from the Urquhart family. So was it always clear you would eventually join the family business or not? Did you maybe think like, oh, maybe not, maybe I'm doing something different?
No, definitely not. So my career progressed from school to university. In fact, before I even went to university, one of the first things I thought I wanted to do was become a pilot in the Royal Air Force.
That's different.
And I went through my various exams and you know, competency tests. But when I was there, I felt, like as I was a young Highland boy, because I was in sort of 16, 17, but I was there in these, going through these processes with people who were already coming out through university with scholarships to go straight into to the RAF. So I felt like I was very young and they had a lot more life experience. And so I thought, this is maybe not the right thing for me now. I just probably wasn't mature enough. And then I went to university, and that took me into the world of construction, and became a surveyor. And then I moved from Aberdeen, where the university was, down to work in Edinburgh. And I was there for almost 7 years, and during that time became a chartered surveyor as well. And then it was at that point that the third generation of the family started sharing more about their hopes and dreams and ambitions for the business. Mm-hmm. But it was very, very well and very logically structured, really to avoid romance, that you wouldn't just come in because you happen to be a part of the family. It had to be right for the business and right for the individual, but also right for everybody else in the business.
Right.
Because we didn't want just people being, you know, dropped into positions that maybe actually other existing colleagues were better for,
So it was not super easy to get into the company just because you're from the family, so you had to apply and do everything like every normal candidate.
Yes, and probably with the toughest interview panel ever, because they're they're your uncles, but you weren't allowed to have any of your own family there. And also our non-executive chairman, who was a wonderful man, and rest in peace, Harry Cathcart was his name, and sadly passed away this year. But he was the one that sort of brought that sort of balance. Mm-hmm. But the first thing that you do when you come to Gordon MacPhail as a family member, it's something that over the years has been open. It was something called the Management Leadership Development Programme. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And so the first thing you do is you learn how to make whiskey. So back to Benromo, of course, for me, and then working alongside at the time Bob Murray and Keith Cruikshank, and you spend, you know, a number of months learning all the details of how you make whiskey. And while there, you do all the associated elements. So you go and learn about the barley, you go to the maltsters, you go and so every aspect is covered. So you get deeply ingrained. And also when you're there, you go out and you visit distilleries, which became, of course, that's never a chore.
No, it's true. So you know all the basics.
All the basics. And then you follow the whiskey. Yeah. And that's the exciting bit. So, of course, the thing Gordon MacPhail is very famous for is taking new make spirit from, well, we've filled over 112 distilleries. So take the new make spirit. And the next element is Gordon MacPhail select our own casks. Okay, so where do the casks come from? What type of oak are we using? So you get into a bit of more deep study about the wood, and then which make from each distillery goes into what style of cask. So
yeah, we'll talk about that in more detail in just a couple of minutes. But now let's still focus on your role. Right now your role is Director of Prestige. That sounds very glamorous. But what does your day-to-day look like?
That was a good question. Somebody just asked me the other day, because part of our sort of mission at Gordon MacPhail is to have a family house of strong brands, but that are prestigious brands. And somebody said, what does prestige mean? Prestigious mean? I said, well, the word prestige means to hold in high regard.
Yes.
So part of my overall role is to make sure that Gordon MacPhail, the brand, the company, is always held in high regard. But back to the point is that about my upbringing, as it were, that detailed understanding of whiskey and how to make whiskey and how whiskey matures and all the rest of it, that's the thing that really underpins it. So it's beginning, it's the whole point is to be able to, for Gordon MacPhail's products to be held in high regard, you need to be able to communicate about them. So my role is very much communicating with the consumer at all levels, especially I do a lot of the majority of the private client work. So that's for our very top end prestigious whiskies. So
lovely.
And when you mention private client work, I don't know if you can reveal or not, but who are the most exciting people you've met?
Do you know what? You meet such a broad spectrum of people. And the one thing I find is that when people have a passion for something, and it can be whiskey, it can be sport, their sport, you tend to find that they're committed to it. And so as a result, you've got a lot in common, you've got a lot to communicate about and share and learn about. And so it's one of these things that you get to know people well. Mm-hmm. And as a result, you tend to find you've got a lot in common. And it doesn't matter what level in the world you're at, what brings you together is that common bond of having a passion for something. Mm-hmm. And the result, of course, is that everybody tends to get on very well. And if you look in the world of whiskey, you know, there's a massive, massive global community around whiskey. And it's joy for the product, and it's the way it's made, and of course, how amazing it tastes.
Now, looking at the amount of people you meet, it must be quite a few, I assume. So have there been any very special requests that you got, like something unusual, maybe? Whiskey can be enjoyed in different ways, and I don't know.
Just an example that we talked to Mark Lancaster at the Dalmore, and they said like they had celebrities coming in for whom they had to clean the warehouses to.
They don't like mold.
Yeah, exactly. So these kinds of requests. Did you have anything that was super special or interesting?
No, nothing quite like that. We have had the how close in my helicopter can I land? We have had. People coming, you know, maybe doing a cruise round Scotland in their super yachts. And where do you recommend I can sort of lay anchor and...
Oh, just down the River Lossie over
yeah.
there.
Yeah, you know, where can I lay anchor and what's the best, you know, little port to take our tender into and things like that. And we've had some interesting requests for utilization of our distilleries. Could we come and do something, you know, a private event for things?
Nice.
Yeah. I'm not going to reveal any others because some of them are maybe just not unrepeatable almost.
that's fine. It's
okay. Yeah.
Maybe before we talk more about Gordon & MacPhail as a company in a few seconds, you already mentioned that the first whiskey you had and enjoyed was with your father, like sitting down, having a quiet time, like
trying
having
to
just
really
a drum.
Appreciate it, yes.
And do you remember what it was?
The first whiskey.
The first one you liked, maybe.
Well, so one...
Or maybe there's a difference. The first one you liked and the first one you drank, probably.
Yeah, it was really interesting. So when I sat down with my dad, he started to tell me his stories. Like, for example, when he was in his... I think we would probably be in early 20s. In his line of work, he did something for a client and he was very grateful, and they gave him a bottle of whiskey, and it happened to be, I won't use the names, but a very, very, very peated whiskey from Islay. And of course, him and my dad and his friend, knowing whiskey, but not knowing the spectrum of whiskey, then they would be used to maybe something like Famous Grouse at the time and things, long before he met my mum, so they tasted this peaty, iodine-like Islay whiskey, thought there was something terribly wrong with it, so poured it down the sink. So, but he had learned his lesson by the time he came to educate me. And of course, with uncles in the business as well, and I used to say, with my Uncle David, you would get a chance to try, you know, a number of whiskies with him as well. So that was what really got me into it. The first whiskey, do you know what? The first whiskey would have been just a blend, and I'll tell you why. We were really lucky, and I will call this company out because it was brilliant. There was two or three of them, and it was Famous Grouse, because Famous Grouse sponsored a whole series of curling tournaments around Scotland.
There you go.
And there was a really great tournament in Inverness, and everybody, talk about the ambition of getting with liquid on lips and whiskey. Everybody would enjoy all these curling tournaments. They were good quality tournaments, high class, you know, good teams involved, but everybody would also know how to enjoy themselves. And so the sponsors at the time would put on, you know, a reception event on the Saturday evening, and everybody would get to try whiskey. Nice. Now, we were pretty decent at curling at a young age, so we would be playing in these tournaments. So when we were young, of course, we didn't drink the whiskey. honest.
Of course.
But we didn't drink the whiskey. But what we did was, when you won the prizes, you went straight to your dad and said, right, how much for this, Dad? And you'd exchange it for money. And our friends at the other distilleries, like Glenfiddich, sponsored a number of tournaments that we played in. But and Macallan used to sponsor the national championships. So,
oh, really?
And so in a loft somewhere, I've got a bag with all these, you know, outfits, you know, mm-hmm. In light colours or dark colours, but all with the livery of the various sponsors. And they're all whiskey companies. And it was brilliant. And it, do you know what? I think back in the 1980s, that would have been something that really propelled sort of whiskey to a much wider base, because people would, you know, would start learning about it, and people would mm-hmm. talk about their weekends and mm-hmm. how much fun they had at these events. So that was probably my first sort of real close interaction with it.
All right. Well, now at this very point, you could probably be the one sponsoring those tournaments. But how did we get there? You said you started off as a grocery business in 1895, I think it was.
That's right.
And now you're one of the best known, most influential independent bottlers of Scotch whiskey. How did that come about?
This is the Gordon McPhill story is one of evolution. It's mm-hmm. one of patience. It's one of very much a very strong set of values, doing right by not just those in the business, but those associated with the business and our local community as well. In 1895, the namesakes of the business, so James Gordon and John McPhail, they opened their doors and they brought in John Urquhart, who came from a farming family, but not a farm-owning family, a farm-working mm-hmm. family, so very blue-collar. And he came into the business and he worked under James Gordon. And James Gordon, as part of that partnership, he brought his knowledge and skills as being a whiskey broker to the business. John McPhail, on the other hand, he brought those experiences of grocery products and together they had this eye that will create something of a sort of a higher quality, higher standard, a sort of a wider offering of greater flavours, as it were, in what they did. And we took the, as they called it, the central and commodious premises on South Street as their home. And then over the next 20 years, they evolved the business. So not only did they have this wide, fine selection of grocery products, they also imported fine wines, mm-hmm. beers, mm-hmm. ales and stouts, but they also they bottled the whiskey as well. And they would take casks into the cellar of the shop and they would create their whiskies there. But because of where we are in what could be seen as one of the capitals of Speyside, you know, between mm-hmm. Elgin and Dufftown, you could argue, we were surrounded by distilleries. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the business was importing these wines, and of course one of the most popular wines of that time was sherry, mm-hmm. as a fortified wine. And of course, when you bottled your sherry, what did you do with the casks? Well, we suddenly had these wonderful vessels that James Gordon and John Urquhart would roll out and then send off to have delivered in a horse and cart, no doubt, in the early days, up to some of the local distilleries. And so we started filling almost immediately with whiskey from these local distilleries. And it's interesting because, of course, people just instantly think, oh, you would have been filling with the likes of maybe our own Ben Romick and mm-hmm. and Glenmurray, of course. But a number of the ones round here, they weren't even open in 1895.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so
right.
In 1895, it would have been Linkwood. It would have been Macallan, it would have been Glen Grant, and it would have been likes of Mortlach, and so these ones that were established much earlier in their early half of the 19th century, back in the 1820s onwards. So,
mm-hmm. But it was still a very bold decision to actually bottle single malt whiskey, right? Because it was all about blends back then.
Yeah, and if you follow all the other big blends, you look at the Ballantyne's family, grocers in Edinburgh, mm-hmm. look at the obvious course, Johnny Walker in Kilmarnock, mm-hmm. you look at the Chivas brothers in Aberdeen, all grocers. But being in in larger towns and cities with a closer, bigger population on your doorstep, it was a lot easier for them to almost get greater traction for their products to sell. We up here, a little bit more, well, a lot more remote, less density of population, it's a little bit harder for us to get traction. But what we did have, with all these names round about us, were known to everybody. So when we brought out, you know, an independent bottling of Glengarant, or a licensed, as they were, a licensed bottling of, you know, a Glenburgie or a Milton Duff or something, you would have had people who knew that and said, oh, farmers would tell you they've sent their, that's where our barley goes, or people would tell us, you know, or would do you happen to have this, because that's our distillery, our family have all worked there. So you would get more nuanced requests. Mm-hmm. And of course, given where we were, and being very much part of the community, which is something that's very much in our DNA today, we became friends with a lot of the local distilleries. And this is when lots of them would have been very independently operated when Gordon MacPhail started. And of course, it was the post-Patterson crash, post-World War One, that things started to come together with Scotch malt distillers and sort of distilling groups started being formed.
All right, yes. And then what's also very special about Gordon and MacPhail is that you started very early doing independent bottling, and that also means you have very old casks lying in your warehouses. But that also means, first, you need the vision. Second, you need the money. And third, you need space and time to do that. So how did you come to the point that you said, we're going to store whiskey for a very, very long time, actually?
So this was the evolution of John and George's involvement in the business. Because we were not one single, we weren't just a whiskey company, we were a wholesale and grocer. What we had was we had effectively one element being able to fund and subsidize the other. And it could seesaw back and forth over time. So as our prominence in whiskey began to grow, of course, like we saw from the other blending companies, the Johnny Walkers and like, well, of course, the whiskey side's become a much more important and more dominating part of the business, to the point that we didn't need the grocery element anymore. But also that element, that world completely changed with the advent of supermarkets. And so through the 70s and 80s, that changed. So that we saw that change. But one thing I think to get the idea right here is what we were doing was, we were not filling thousands of casks every year. In fact, we were filling quite small numbers with a lot of distilleries. And when I say small numbers, you could count on one hand. You know, we'd have maybe five casks being filled at certain distilleries. Others that maybe our relationships were stronger, or there was years when we could afford to fill more, we would go and fill with certain distilleries where maybe our relationship was stronger, or we saw that they actually could do with more support. And so we tended to evolve in a fairly iterative manner through time. So, but by having almost the one half of the business that was being successful as a grocer and wholesaler, that helped sort of support laying down of more and more
security
casks.
Very important point.
Also, but still in an interview on your website, you described George Urquhart, I think your grandfather then, as, and I quote, he was described of being eccentric to the point of mad. And how far did and does that positive madness that he had and the vision that he had at a very early stage, and how far does it shape what Gordon and MacPhail is today?
Yeah, it was about commitment, and that George was committed to quality. So when he saw, well, if you think about it, you could go down two routes. You know, I can either follow what my head and heart tells me is the right thing to do, which is to create really high quality single malt, working hand in glove with these wonderful friends and partners at these distilleries, or I can try and compete with the world and have a blended product out there, which for a small business, that was out with our scaling. And, so he went against the grain. But not only by going against the grain, and you hear the term, it's like pushing water uphill, but in his case, pushing whiskey uphill, trying to persuade people to try single malts. When, of course, the whole thought of a blend was to create an even rounder, complex but evenly balanced whiskey. That's why you would put the blend various components together to create something that the whole was greater than the sum of its parts. And here's a man that was trying to say, well, no, just why don't you buy this single expression of this one distillery? However, in order to make it as high quality as possible, I've aged it for longer, which has helped, of course, round out the flavours, bring more balance to it, more complexity to it. And of course, and then use maybe some casks from, you know, several casks from that distillery together to create a wonderful 10-year-old or 15-year-old. But George went beyond that, and this is where the quote came from. This was from his peers. George would have like 21, 25, 30, and onwards to 40, etc., 50 years old. And those in the industry said, George, you know, why are you doing this? You know, you are eccentric to the point of mad. And the evidence was, it was really interesting. So in 1972, my uncle David came into the business. And so when David retired back in 2012 as a sort of operational head in the business, we pulled out a price list from the day he started, and there was of course pages and pages of different blends that we were wholesaling, and then there was pages of Gordon MacPhail's whiskies, and there was a small section for other people, other actual single malts available in the market, which was 8 or 9. But we had at the time, it was one of our licensed bottlings of Macallan. It was from 1937 and so it was a 35 year old. And so this is a quiz for you guys.
Okay.
In 1972, when we were in pounds and pence by this point in the United Kingdom, at the time, a blended Scotch might have been £1.50 a bottle, maybe £1.80. Good quality, you know, more deluxe expressions, £2, £2.20, £2.30. Some of the eight-year-old single malts, with which there is, as I say, 6 or 7, they were maybe £2.50. Maybe a wee bit more than that, £3, maybe max. So how much do you think was a 35-year-old?
From 1937.
From 1937.
Back then, I would say it was horribly expensive and it cost £18.
Okay.
I don't believe that, because in a market where you have problems selling single malt, or you're just trying to get people to buy single malt, you probably have to make it very affordable. So it's probably going to be in the 150-ish range.
Well, close. You're going to get a lot of change.
Not a bad thing.
No. So £4.54.
All right.
So, yeah, but there you go. But persuading people, somebody to buy something that is £3 the price of a bottle of blend.
Yeah. Right.
You know, which, so back then, and of course, I came into the industry in 2000, and I would walk into places and people would sort of, you know, in bars and high quality places where folk would be in drinking, and they would say, "Oh, who's the sales rep?" You know, and you go in and there'd be folk there, and you would get you know, a gentleman of particular age standing at the side and going, "Oh, these single malts, oh, it doesn't get any better than a 10-year-old. And then he would give you an argument about why the whiskey was just is perfectly good there and you didn't need to make it any better, or certainly more expensive in his eyes. And of course, the next time I would be there, I would come in, the same guy would be sitting there and he would say, "It doesn't get any better than 12 years old. And then, then it became 15 and so on. And then, of course, he stopped arguing because he suddenly realized that actually that the aging process, as he began to let his own palate expand, he realized that there was an awful lot more to this, and and there was a real change in the flavors and complexities and the sophistication. And so back to the question, that was what George believed, he and his father believed, that he was, by aging it in the right wood, you were creating outstanding quality single malt.
Yes.
And it's something today, my uncle Michael, he it's one of his great quotes, and that is, quality never goes out of fashion.
No, yeah, true.
It's not wrong.
Very true.
Yeah. So now let's move away from the independent bottling business a little bit, because actually, in addition to that, you also run two of your own distilleries, which are Benroma and The Cairn. So we recorded an episode with Keith Cruikshank at Benroma a few years ago, and we asked him, "Hey, Keith, so if you could go wherever, what would be the best whiskey place in the world where you could spend one day, do whatever you want?" And he said, like, "You know what? I love Benroma, but it would be the Gordon and MacPhail warehouse. Do you agree?
Yes.
Short answer, yes.
Well, where else are you going to get 100 and probably about 110 different makes? I think actually now, since our 125th anniversary, we're down four. Because for our 125th anniversary, we bottled the last casks we had from Colburn, Glenurie Royal down near Stonehaven or in Stonehaven, and Mostowie and Glencraig. Mm-hmm. Nice. And those last two were the Lowman Stills out in Milton Duff and Glenburgie. So but where else are you going to get, you know, circa 105, yeah, 6 different distilleries under one roof from years 1940 to present day?
So we're convinced.
Yeah, well, I mean, sounds like the perfect whiskey place, yeah, honestly. Now, about Ben Romach, and this is another bold decision, or quite the vision. You bought it in 1993, and that was a time when Scotch whiskey was basically on its way down. Many distilleries had closed in the late 80s.
Yeah. There was a batch closing around the 1990s. You know, if you think Rosebank and various others all closed or were completely repurposed.
Exactly,
or the final decision to clear it, just say, right, they're off the books now.
Yeah, you decided to buy Ben Romach. How come?
Well, do you know what? Again, this was very visionary of both my grandfather, but also the third generation. So Ian Urquhart, David and Michael, and of course my mum as well. But what they saw was the fact that with the obviously the great downturn in the industry from 83, 85 onwards, that there was the actual whisky companies themselves were, of course, as they do, looking around, say, right, what's our next move? And you could see that they were turning into go for malt. Mm-hmm. And we knew that also as the world was advancing, of course, what was becoming very, very prevalent was what the key thing to own was of course, your identity. You know, today mm-hmm. it's obvious your IP is everything. So they saw this coming and they said, well, do you know what? A bit like what happened around the turn of the Patterson crash, people went, look, we're going to have to secure our own source here. If we don't, then at risk of external forces. And the risk we have is if we had, you know, partners that we'd been working hand in glove with turn to us and say, we're not going to give you any fillings anymore. That would have an immediate impact. So we said, oh, no, we want to complete the circle. And I use this example, if you imagine it like a clock face, so at 1 minute past 12, the spirit's been made, that's when Gordon MacPhail take it and put it mm-hmm. into our casks. Now, for the next 45 minutes of the clock is the aging process. And so we'll age it for whatever time is right by the whiskey. And then, of course, we bottle it, and then we distribute it, and ultimately we either sell it to customers directly through our shop or... and in the modern world online or through our partners, all our retailers around the world and bars and things, and who ultimately get it into a consumer's hand and hopefully onto their lips. So, and that takes you to the start. That one bit we didn't do was, and it was a dream of ours to do, was the actual distilling of liquid. Mm-hmm. So in a way, most people will come into it by saying, right, we're going to start distilling. What kind of spirit do we want? We had the foresight to be able to look at our stocks and go, what kind of spirits do we have that we admire, that we think, and where the trends are going and what people are drinking? Because we had that three-dimensional picture. Mm-hmm. And so when we got Ben Romach, what we didn't do was automatically just go and try and recreate what Ben Romach was. It was a very admired and respected spirit at Ben Romach, and it was beautiful. Mm-hmm. But we knew we couldn't just necessarily create that's sort of very sort of lighter based, sort of quite fruity, softer style of Speyside whiskey, because you were coming up against all the really great companies and the big brands of the time. And we were never going to have, we didn't just want to be a Me Too brand. To your words, we had mm-hmm. to be bolder. Mm-hmm. But what did we know? Well, we went into our liquid library and we could look back and see from even whiskies from the 30s, the 40s, 50s, and into the 60s all had this little hint of smoke to them. Yeah. And if you think of why, well, yeah, it's about the time, isn't it? It's about access to coal and anthracite to, yeah, run your place and use of more peat and et cetera, because it was probably on your land and you could access it as a local fuel source much easier. But also, those distilleries back then would have been direct fired. You would have had your maltings on site. The whole environment was one of a greater sort of smokiness. And of course, you know, you would have that would have passed itself onto either through the actual process of with the malt or just from being around. It would have had given us this whiskies. And what we noticed was lots of whiskey connoisseurs through the 90s and were saying things like, oh, the whiskies from back then were outstanding. They were made differently to the way, mm-hmm, they were being made now. And they had more nuances, more characteristics, more complexity. And you looked at it and went, well, yeah, they've also got this. They've got in with that broader range of flavor. They've got this hint of smoke.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So why don't we almost go back to becoming more traditional? Mm-hmm. Now, while we didn't reinstate the malt floors, which are there at Benromic, we said, but you know, there was a reason everybody moved away to utilize maltsters. Yeah. And so we said, let's do that, but we'll specify our malt to a phenol content. And we worked for the first few years at Benromic. We played about, and then we got to settle on that 12 ppm, mm-hmm, as our sort of, lovely, core style. So yeah,
it's very interesting. Yet you said it, you took Benromic over and it was already there. You changed a few things, but with the cairn, you had the opportunity to do something entirely new.
Yeah.
So now, what is it like to start a new distillery compared to taking one over? It must be an amazing feeling to have something like that.
Oh, yes. It's fantastic. But look, I'm going to give the credit here goes to Ewan McIntosh, my cousin Stuart, my cousin Neil was involved, and the whole team, there was a chap, Marty Garstrang, project managed it. But the whiskey, those whiskey minds, Ewan and Stuart, and with the background of with Michael and Ian, and who contributing and adding some absolute amazing value to the whole thing. Because again, speaking, you've got folk that have been working, all of them, Ewan over 30 years in the industry by this point, Stuart by this point was certainly over 10 and moving on, but you had then Michael and Ian and David, bless him while he was with us, they all could contribute this from their knowledge, which by this point's now knocking on for 40, 50 years in the industry. So he had this amazing concept, but what we asked ourselves is, who's going to be drinking this in, say, 15 years' time?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And with the world and wealth moving south and east, and there was another gentleman involved as well, David King. He was working with us at the time, and he came up with a lot of amazing insights as well. And what was brilliant was we all sat down and we talked about it and said, who's going to drink this in the future? And that person, is it going to be male? Is it going to be female? Probably going to be both. What's their style going to be like? Well, we know where there's more and more whiskey being drunk at the moment, and they like, you know, a stronger, sweeter style. So actually, is it more sherried? Is it more of a medium to full style? What's it going to do? So we're trying to follow almost the map of where the populace will drink, and you're sort of saying, actually, but that person in 15 years' time is only, you know, if they're going to be 30 years old, they're only 15 years old now. Mm-hmm. I wonder what they're doing now that will, you know. So you look at what, mm-hmm, folk are eating and drinking now and what's going to be conditioning their palates to what they're going to be drinking then. So we tried to apply some science, but then we also had a knowledge of what we felt in our hearts was the right thing to do. So,
and with all of that in mind, like, and somehow between the science and between what you feel in your heart and also the experience that you have, do you approach maturation differently for your own spirit compared to the spirit that you get from the other distilleries?
So I like to use the term nature and nurture. So from other distilleries, it's got its DNA. Mm-hmm. It's about recognizing its DNA. What's its flavor profile? What's its weight? What's its texture like? And then following on from what John and George did, and then Ian did, and then now my cousin Stuart does, they're matching the cask types to that style of spirit. what we've been able to do is create a style of spirit. We go, right, we know this is going mm-hmm. to work really well in particular styles. So, for example, at Benromic at the moment, we're filling just first fill bourbon and first fill sherry, but in both mm-hmm. hogshead and butt sizes, mm-hmm. but also using a combination of European and American oak for the bigger casks. So we're giving ourselves a lot of potential flavour to play about with to create wonderful expressions of Benromic, but a bit of variety within it. When we came to the cairn, we said, right, what's the lessons? So I always ask two questions. Sophie will agree with me here. Two questions, which is, what went well? Even better if. So if we could have our time again, what would we do differently? And the answer is, we probably would have filled maybe some second fill casks. Mm-hmm. We don't tend to go beyond second fill in a G&M at all, but we probably would have done that because that would have allowed us to maybe go really long term at Benromic yeah. and recreate yeah. some of the amazing whiskies that we're seeing today from Benromic from back in the 70s. So 50-year-old plus stuff, it's incredible. So if we had our, we could maybe do that. So we'll take that learning and we apply it to the cairn. And with Mari, big shout out to Mari, our distiller, she's now head of distilling for the whole of Gordon MacPhail and her team out there with Ali and Wayne and Lexi and Brian. You know, they're now making a phenomenal spirit that we're really, really proud of. And we're now using sherry cask, but in first fill and refills. Mm-hmm. And so we're doing something different.
Yeah, but we'll have to go for a podcast.
Speak to all of them. Go and get them together. Amazing. That'd be great.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It was all about creating something completely different to Benromic. Because there was no point in creating something that would compete against ourselves. Yeah, right. So
it wouldn't make much sense. Now, getting back to the independent bottling, you talked about your whiskey spirits library already. What was the number again of distilleries that you've got there?
I worked out that we have filled 112 different distilleries over our 130 plus years.
Oh, wow. And now, when you have a look at the current whiskey landscape in Scotland, there are still distilleries popping up. There have been new additions just recently. Would you also add those to your stock, or is there just a cap where you say, no, we're there and that's where it's going to be?
Do you know what? It's what's interesting now is some of those distilleries maybe wouldn't want to fill because, mm-hmm. again, about that IP, and maybe they want to learn about how others do it, and maybe if they would do it mm-hmm. under different names and things like that. But also, Gordon MacPhail have been doing this for so long. You could say that in many regards, yes, some distilleries would have been doing something on either a private scale or a local scale. But Gordon MacPhail, for lots of them, became the licensed bottler. Mm-hmm. I worked out there was 28 distilleries that we had effectively done a distillery label for of sorts. Right. Mm-hmm. But under the Connoisseur's Choice range alone, we filled over 88 different distilleries have featured throughout the last, 58 years. Under Connoisseur's Choice. So that's a lot. And the fear is that over that time, we've experimented. We were the first to do sort of finishing. We did a lot of wholly matured stuff, through the 60s and 70s and into the 80s, wholly matured in brandy, wholly matured in port, wholly mm-hmm. matured in certain sherries and the like. And so we've done that. But what we wanted to always do was work hand in glove with distilleries. We always said we were not here to compete. We're here to complement. Mm-hmm. And again, if Gordon MacPhail weren't putting just phenomenal whiskey into the bottle, and you, let's just say it was a distillery, any pick a name of a distillery in Highlands or Speyside, and imagine you weren't doing that good job, who's going to give you a filling next time? Mm-hmm. But by doing a good job, you're only supporting them. And so then when they ended up coming to do it themselves, guess what? Okay, it might not have been in a mass scale, but there would have been a general knowledge of that whiskey being out there and it being of really good quality. So people went, hey, I like this. I'm going to go and try this one. And so what we did was work by complementing, never competing. Where we are today, though, is lots of distilleries are doing all of that themselves. Mm-hmm. Finishing, cask maturations, everything. Where can we add some value or mm-hmm. point of difference? So this is where the sort of the element of where does that point of difference come from? There's mm-hmm. there's a lot of new distilleries, and many are making some fabulous spirit, which is brilliant to see. And some Gordon MacPhail have been filling with, but not that many. Mm-hmm. So and again, that's probably comes on us a wee bit maybe, but also on them, because I think at the time, a lot of these places have been built because the future just looked so rosy, didn't it?
Yeah.
Everything
yeah,
was
right.
on the up, mm-hmm. And the people coming into distilling now won't have experienced what, you know, maybe the likes of ourselves and the families like the Glenfarclas, the Grants, William Grant and Sons, so the Grant Gordons, and what we've all seen over 130 plus years,
yeah,
which is
right.
the ups and downs and when to button down the hatches, when to lean in a bit more and fill more, when to take their foot off the gas a bit, etc. You know, as a family, we've seen that through, you know, four generations. So, and we're just, you know, at this point in time, we're in one of these, you know, slight dips again.
Mm-hmm.
But we all hope and fingers crossed it comes out the other side. So
yeah, it will eventually, I assume. Sure. So yeah. It's always going up and down. But now let's maybe talk about something that makes Gordon and MacPhail very special. It's these very, very old bottlings. We have talked about this a little bit, but there are bottlings that are more than twice our age, at least. So like 70, 75, 80, 85 even. So how do you decide which whiskies can mature for such a long time? How do you make sure, or how do you know this whiskey is one that can stay in the cask for such a long time?
So that all comes from experience and knowledge passed down through the generations. And because you've got one family that's looking at something over such a long period mm-hmm. of time, I think it's quite, there's not many companies that could do that, because you've not had the continuity of people
yeah.
and sharing the same ideals
yeah,
and the same
right.
philosophies. And I think being a family business puts us in a really unique place, because it's not mm-hmm. it's not always about just being delivering to hit the demands of a market or shareholders or, you know, to generate dividends or bonuses for people. It's about doing right by the whiskey. And I remember my uncle being asked one day, a big corporation came in and said, we would like an award-winning 10-year-old single malt. We want it to this price and we want to do this. And is that possible? You guys, you've got a great reputation. And my uncle looked at him and said, yes, that's no problem at all. How many cases did you need? And it was into the thousands. And he says, yeah, that's no problem at all. Come back in 10 years. So, because what we had, though, was we had experience. And we had experience seeing casks evolve and mature. So in the early days, we noticed, well, my great-grandfather would have started to notice that particular styles of whiskey matured better in certain styles of casks.
Mm-hmm.
That was then shared with George. George then takes it and adds even more nuance to it and says, right, that style of whiskey going into this style of cask, what about this style of cask, and giving alternatives. And then as you see the whiskies evolve and change, having the bravery to say, look, if I've got five whiskies in front of me, what do I need today? Well, I need one of them. Right, which is the one that's drinking best today? This one. Okay, what do we think of this, the second one? Well, actually, it's also really good, but it's maybe got space and room to grow a little bit and change. You know, can see the evolution there. The trick is keep your samples.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the next time you pull the samples out, you can then look at them and go, how's it changed?
Compare,
how's it
yeah.
evolved?
Yeah, yeah.
And so fast forward, take the 85-year-old, fast forward to today. My cousin Stuart's looking at it. He's looking at the past bottlings we've done. He's looking at the cast samples we've drawn over the years. And he's going, right, we're now in a situation where actually this is sensational. And there's the one bit you don't know, and that is, at 75, 80, 85, you're basing your knowledge on the rate of evolution mm-hmm. of the whiskey. And you just don't know what's coming down the track
yeah.
tomorrow.
So
if there's
yeah.
something, and that's the bit you don't know. For everything before that, though, you've now got a track record. So you can go, actually, we saw this at this stage and this is what it was doing. And obviously you need to know the strength of the whiskey. You need to know how much is in the cask, the condition of the cask, how is it holding up really well. And then, and only then do you go, right, this is what we want. And I suppose it's worth touching at this point is what this monitoring of whiskey has led us to understand that the staves, the thickness of the staves that we have in our casks are really important. Yeah, if you're looking for long-term maturation, and we learned that from using the transport casks that sherry would be transported all the way to Scotland in. So what we would do is we would then speak to our coopers back in Spain and say, can you make our casks to a different specification with thicker staves, etc., so that we had more robust casks. And that's what helped us.
You need a good
cask
for such a long time. Yeah.
Well, that's my grandfather. It was his sort of watchword. It's the wood that makes the whiskey. And it was all about the quality of the cask. And to this day, people, you know, we hear stories wherever we go into distilleries and folk will say, oh, it's a special day when the Gordon MacPhail casks turn up and things like that, because, you know, they see the quality of wood, because we're not filling huge numbers of casks at distilleries. They see these small numbers of really beautiful hand-selected casks turning up.
Now, talking about those very, very long maturations, just one last question. Is there a certain flavor note that you feel only comes out after that very long maturation? Is there something super special about them?
That's a really great question. I'm going to refer you to something that a few people have said to us over the years, that these old casks almost have, there's almost like a Gordon and MacPhail flavor. It's really interesting. If you speak to some of the folk, it's almost that our warehouses here in Elgin, what we learned, and again, Stuart's a bit of a professor around this sort of stuff, as was his uncle, our uncle Ian, about making sure your warehouses stay full, making sure that the UK is as even an environment as possible to get such a nice, even, balanced maturation. But especially because we've used a lot of casks that would have been a Rich Oloroso, that would have also come from, the cask would have come from certain bodegas, like Williams and Humbert, of course. What we would have had is, we would have had such a good consistency in the wood that we're using, that we almost created this hallmark note in our maturing older whiskies. So beautiful old Glen Grants, old Macallans, old Mortlachs, you know, old Linkwoods, old Glenlivets and like, just have this, it's hard to describe. It's there's a touch of the, it's almost like an old Gordon MacPhail library, is that, you know, in that it's got just something a little bit different about it. It's a little bit sort of parchment, old parchment paper, but in a dark tea with really rich sort of over-oxidized fruits that are beautiful and still ripe and succulent, and you just want to eat them. So they've not gone off yet, if you know what I mean, but they've got an intensity to them. And you get, I think that's been a hallmark. But what we're seeing is really popular now with some of our whiskies that, like the Generations 85 and the 80, ones that have actually, casks that have been sherry but have been in American oak, and how they've seemed to have gone through some sort of evolution that creates these amazing ripe, more tropical style fruits in them. And it's amazing. So you get the different combinations. So
all right, well, I mean, that sounds very, very lovely. Yeah. But unfortunately not many people will be able to actually even experience these types of tastes. But
well, you say that, because of course a bottle of this whiskey is, they're very, very expensive. But what Gordon MacPhail do here in Elgin is, we're trying to bring these to life. So you can actually come to the store here in Elgin, and you can do a tasting. So while one of these, if you try to buy some of these amazing whiskies in a bar, you know, they could cost you a fortune. You're certainly buying a bottle, you might think, oh my goodness. But actually,
my car.
But if you come here, we do give people the opportunity to come and taste so that they can enjoy them. But then all of a sudden, by understanding them, then it is such a much more confident purchase, and they're not buying something that will come with any remorse at any point, so they'll come with actually a confidence in what they want, and that's really important to us, because then all of a sudden you suddenly open their eyes to think, actually this is a remarkable whiskey, and hopefully then what they do is they can buy it with a particular objective in mind. Now, for example, if you go back and order whiskies from maybe a particular birth year, it could be something that you would want to share with your father or mother or family members.
Right.
And suddenly that whiskey's got so much more incredible value for you.
True.
Yes. You know, and I think there's a lot
Gordon McPhail. Emotional value also.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think that sort of Jane Gordon McPhail with the variety, with the ages, I think you can find something that's really made for your moment. And if it is something you would maybe just push the boundaries in your budgets, you can go, actually, and I'm going to do this and I know I'm going to really enjoy it, because the value, the emotional value that will bring will outweigh any other value I could get out of this.
And it's so cool that you've got them all. You'll find emotional value for basically everybody out there.
Yeah, there's something for everyone in the warehouses.
Yeah, the entire range, so.
Yeah.
And now, before we jump to the last three quick questions, one last thing. So we can tell from the way you speak about your job and your role and Gordon and McPhail that you are really... You love the
you
job.
Love what you do.
You love what you do. So we can see that in your face, and we can also hear that. Now, what excites you most about the future of Gordon and McPhail?
Oh, that's a great question. right, what excites me most is there's sort of really two, maybe even three parts to this. Firstly, you know, you recognize in life that you're not going to be around forever, so it's never about the individual.
Yeah, right.
So therefore, and for us to survive, okay, it's about, as my grandfather always said, somebody somewhere's got to be enjoying our whiskey, but we also need people that can communicate about our whiskey. So what really excites me is the growth of the people that work for Gordon McPhail and the ability that their futures and going out into the world and sharing, sharing the joy of the Gordon McPhail whiskies, our heritage, and being in the moment with people. So I think that's wonderful. I think, and also the people that have to look after these amazing whiskies, knowing that they could be handling a cask today, that's they've been involved in the cask selection. You know, I'm thinking about Lizzie, or I'm thinking about the people at the distilleries laying down the spirit, or the cask teams, and they're laying stuff down that people will talk about them and. You know, 50 years going, well, do you know what, this was laid down for them, and remember Lizzie was out selecting the casks in Spain with Stuart, and you know, it's so I think there's that side of things, so the people side, and I think that's great. The other thing, you know, from my point of view is I think the Cairn and Ben Romich, and that they're both at different levels in their and they're growing up. They're
obviously,
you know, we've got the Cairn. I discovered distilleries. If anybody out there listening ever thinks about distilleries, they're like having children. In that, even in the early days, it's like when your child gets a paper round. You know, goes and starts delivering papers for a few pounds a week. You know, it's not enough to pay their way or anything. So they're still going to cost you money. And then they go to school and then university and you know, and they still cost you money. And it's not until they're a bit older that you suddenly realise that you can actually get them off your books, as it were, or they start paying back, so to speak. And that's what distilleries are like, in that they'll cost you money from day one for a long, long time before you start. And so you have to be mindful of your models and how you go about that. So I think Gordon McPhail is because of time, with the beauty of having time and experience on our sides, that it's about making sure that our business, our model always remains in balance, that we can afford to bring up the stars of tomorrow, as it were.
Yeah, right.
A bit like investing in our people, bringing on the stars of tomorrow. And Ben Romich is more advanced, and of course we're in a situation where we're now we're now enjoying 21, 23, we're going to have 25-year-old Ben Romich, you know, and so we've been lucky enough that we saw again the even better if question, even better if we actually had made a bit more in the early days, because we did start off very small then, but now we've, you know, the team there have Keith, and now it's Murdo, of course. We've got this situation where we've now been making more, so we now have that more to sell, so it can be much more sustainable going into the future. But also, really, we can really push on and really make a really great brand of it, because it's got so much soul, Benomic. You know, it's got a real great personality.
I really imagine that to be great, great to see. Now, we're getting towards the end of the podcast, and as you already mentioned, we always finish with a couple of quick questions, so just sharp, short answers, all right? Now, what's your celebration drum after winning a big game of curling?
1956, Glen Grant.
Oh, sounds okay.
Good choice. What's the drum when you lose a game?
That's a great question. I think it'd probably be the same. No.
That's okay.
Commiserations.
You never lose.
Oh, I wish. I wish you could say that. No. Do you know what? It depends. It depends how sore the loss was.
So next time you let us know when you lose. Yeah. So second quick question: curling stone or whiskey cask? Which one is harder to control?
Oh, that's a great question. Whiskey casks, we lay down with intent on the view that we know it's going to do what it's going to do, or we hope. However, you are always playing with Mother Nature here, so you can get variances. But curling stone's made of natural material as well, so it can sometimes have a mind of its own. And I think I think if you're the master of both, but like some of the teams at the Olympics at the moment, I think... I see my cousin Stuart and his team as the Olympians of cask maturation, so they can control it pretty well.
Very nice. And now, last question. One person, dead or alive, to share the 85-year-old Glenlivet with, who is it going to be?
My granddad. Nice. George. Could you imagine going back and saying, hey...
This is you.
This is what your madness brought us.
You and your father laid this one down. But I would love to just sit down and ask him so many questions about... When did you do this? Why did you do that? When, you know, all these things that, and what was it like dealing with that company back then? And, you know, that would be...
I can't imagine it to turn into this. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I think we cannot find better last words than imagining you and your granddad and his father even maybe to sit and have this drum and conversation. So thanks a lot, Stephen, for all the insights and for having us here at Gordon and MacPhail in Elgin. And if you want to get to know more about Gordon and MacPhail, follow them on social media at Gordon and MacPhail, visit their website at gordonandmacphail.com, or visit them up here in Elgin for a great tasting experience of maybe whatever age you want, right?
of anything. Or come and see us at some of the, you know, the shows around the world we do.
Please
come and be our guest and at any of these places. And thank you both. Very much indeed for coming up to Elgin and seeing us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.
We are Miriam and Martin, and this was Inside Whiskey with Stephen Ranking of Gordon and MacPhail.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Thank you for joining us on the Barrel Talk today. If you enjoyed this episode, tune in again next time for some more tales about the water of life. And in the meantime, follow us on Instagram at @inside_whiskey, on Facebook at Inside Whiskey The Barrel Talk, or visit our website on insidewhiskey.de. This was Inside Whiskey, The Barrel Talk. Thank you.